Welcome to the Friday, May 9th, it's Katie Murphy's birthday episode of On Iowa Politics. On this week's podcast, Iowa's new state immigration law is headed to the courts. A few more looks back at the legislative session because we just can't help ourselves. And this past weekend's Republican Party of Iowa State Convention. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me this week are Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hola.
Lead Des Moines Bureau Chief Caleb McCullough is here. Hello, Caleb.
Aaron, happy birthday as well to Quad City Times editor Tom Martin, if Facebook can be trusted.
Well, first of all, when can Facebook not be trusted? As reliable right. a source as you will ever find. But thanks for that. Happy birthday to Tom, too. Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal is with us. Hello, Jared.
Rest in peace to Steve Albini, one of music's all-time great producers.
Yes. Yep, absolutely. And finally, we have with us Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. Whose birthday is it in your universe, Todd?
No one. No one was born today, as far as I know.
All right. Let's start this week with the newest of news as we record here on Thursday afternoon. Our Tom Barton is fresh from an online news conference where it was announced that a lawsuit has been filed to challenge a new state law regarding illegal immigration. Quick background here, the law, which passed with only Republican support in the Iowa legislature, made it illegal for a migrant who was previously deported to re-enter Iowa's borders and authorized state and local law enforcement to arrest and deport any such migrants. Republicans who supported the bill say it was necessary because, as they see it, the federal government has insufficiently enforced federal immigration laws. Democrats and critics in the migrant and law enforcement communities in Iowa said the law has serious logistical issues and will harm the relationship between Iowa's law enforcement and immigrant communities. Tom, tell us about who is filing this lawsuit and what they had to say. And I guess I'm curious, what are the grounds for? What's the legal argument they're making here?
Yeah, so the legal arguments that they're making here are not that similar to the legal arguments that we're seeing in a similar case in Texas. The Iowa law is very similar to that Texas law, which right now is temporarily enjoined or blocked from going into effect while a federal appeals court weighs a challenge to a lower court's ruling that struck down the measure. The lower court found that the law threatens the fundamental notion that the United States, the federal government, must regulate immigration with one voice. It's a similar argument that we see in the lawsuit that was filed today by Iowa civil rights and immigrant rights groups. So the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Iowa, and the American Immigration Council filed the lawsuit in U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Iowa on behalf of Iowa Migrant Movement for Justice and the thousands of immigrants that the organization assists, including two anonymous immigrants who were named individually as plaintiffs in the suit. So the law is set to take effect July 1, and as you mentioned, it makes it a state crime for someone to attempt to enter Iowa after being previously deported or barred from entering the United States. Groups intend to ask a federal court for a preliminary injunction to block the law from being enforced during the course of the litigation and prior to July 1. Attorneys for the groups involved in this lawsuit say that they plan on filing a motion for a preliminary injunction soon, as possibly as early as tomorrow. And so they argue in the suit that, again, Iowa law conflicts with existing federal law and interferes with the federal government's authority to enforce immigration law. They also allege that the state law would allow Iowa immigrants with legal status to be arrested and deported, again, going against immigration laws set by the U.S. Congress. So Senate File 2340 creates new crimes for anyone in Iowa, including a child, they note in the lawsuit, who has re-entered the country after being deported, even if that person is now authorized to be in the United States. So the legislation states that a court may not halt prosecution under the law on the basis that a federal determination regarding the immigration status of the person is pending or will be initiated. And so they argue that, you know, this would ensnare Iowa immigrants who either have been granted asylum, are applying for asylum, who may have special visas given to them because they're survivors of domestic violence or other crimes. Lawsuit highlights an 18-year-old that it refers to as Anna. It's a pseudonym used to protect her identity. The suit states that Anna was born in Honduras, where her father was murdered and her sister kidnapped. And she fled to the U.S. with her mother in 2019 when she was 14 years old. She and her mother were deported in 2020. And shortly after, still fearing for her life, Anna returned to the U.S. again, this time unaccompanied. She applied for and received asylum and is now living in Iowa lawfully with an Iowa family and is attending high school. Attorneys in the suit are arguing that under Senate File 2340, she could be arrested and deported to the Mexican border where she has no family or connection. The other plaintiffs referred to in the lawsuit include Jane Doe. That's a 68-year-old grandmother with health problems who is currently a lawful permanent resident of the United States. She's a native of Mexico, has lived in the U.S. for several years. Talks about how she came to the country without authorization to join her husband, who became a lawful permanent resident in the 80s. She returned to Mexico in 2005 after her mother died. But when she tried to return, she was detained at the border. Because her husband was a citizen, she applied lawfully to return. However, the application wasn't approved before her husband's death. And it wasn't until 2022 that she was able to return to Iowa. And again, even though she holds a green card, the suit argues that under this law, she could be put in prison and deported.
Yeah, and I should have noted at the top, dude, this is on the heels of the federal Justice Department has already said that if Iowa attempts to enforce this law, and this was before this lawsuit was filed, if Iowa were to attempt to enforce this law, that the DOJ would sue over that action as well. So obviously this one's now going through the legal process, and it'll be interesting to see what comes. Did they have any sense of a timeline, Tom? I usually in these cases where they ask for an injunction, you know, I guess you said the law goes into effect July 1st. They'd like to have a ruling on the temporary injunction by then, I assume.
That's correct. I asked the legal director for the ACLU of Iowa, Rita Bettis Austin, that question. And essentially, you know, she said the same thing that you said. You know, typically in these cases, when they're requesting a preliminary injunction, the courts rule fairly quickly and said that, you know, while they don't have, you know, set timeline or time frame as to, you know, when the courts would actually rule on their motion, which they still have to file, she felt fairly confident and comfortable that the courts would act on this before July 1st, when the law is set to take effect. And it's worth noting, related to the DOJ, they did the same thing in Texas. And so essentially, and you also had civil rights and immigrant groups in Texas file separate lawsuits or a separate lawsuit against that law. So essentially, the same thing that's playing out in Texas is now playing out in Iowa over this very similar law. I looked earlier today, I don't know, it doesn't look like the DOJ has filed their lawsuit yet against the state, but that's expected to come here pretty shortly, you know, if not in the next couple of days, potentially, you know, the next couple hours.
All right. Very good. Obviously one that we're going to be talking about again in the future. So let's move on. This past weekend, the Republican Party of Iowa held its state convention here in Des Moines. And as is the tradition, all of the candidates on the ballot for the top races in 2024 spoke at the event, including a few primary challenges to congressional incumbents. And of course, there was the rallying of support around the party's likely presidential candidate, former President Donald Trump. Caleb, you covered the convention for the team. And those are some long days, those state conventions. Give us some highlights.
Yeah, I mean, the primary tussle was definitely one of the more interesting parts of the convention. You know, you had Jeff Kaufman, the party chair, and Kim Reynolds speak about the need to support Donald Trump and to elect Republicans to back to the Congress. Then we got into the candidate speeches, and you had candidates in the fourth and the first districts, Kevin Virgil and David Pouch, They're both Republicans running against the incumbents. Those would be Randy Feenstra and Marianne Miller Meeks in those districts. And they accused their opponents of not being conservative enough, of not holding more closely to the most conservative kind of wing of the Republican Party. Feenstra's opponent pointed to his vote to approve tax credits for carbon capture pipelines, which has been a big point of contention in that primary. One of them, I think it was Pouch, referenced the Iowa Republicans' support for the FISA legislation this year that passed, reauthorizing some broad government surveillance authorities. That was opposed both by kind of some far-right Republicans and some far-left Democrats in Congress. So it was one of those interesting splits there. They did get quite a bit of applause, especially Kevin Virgil from the delegates gathered in the audience. Obviously, it's hard to tell. That type of event tends to be, you know, the most conservative activists in the party. It seemed like it was more skewed to that group. So it's hard to tell if that was kind of indicative of the interest in the broader party. Randy Feenstra was not able to make it. He had a surgery done a few days before, so he wasn't there. But Marianne Miller Meeks was there, and you know, when she got up, she did not directly address her opponent, but she said, pointed to the fact that it was going to be a tight race this year. It was a toss-up district, and that recent polling shows that voters in that district prefer a Democratic candidate on a generic ballot. But you know, she said that essentially implied that she's the only Republican who can win that district, and that it would be foolish to nominate another candidate other than her. And so that was very interesting. It was just interesting to see the reaction from the candidates there. The other kind of inside baseball interesting thing that happened was the some of the discussion around the platform, particularly when it comes to the plank advocating for traditional marriage between a man and a woman, and saying that they advocate for the repeal of laws authorizing same-sex marriage. And so that, from what I gathered from kind of the discussion there, there was a lot of parliamentary debate about whether those that platform plank was improperly removed during the platform committee process. So it seems that each district convention authorized and voted for a plank to reaffirm that that belief for the Republican Party. And that was in the 2022 platform. And by the time it got out of the platform committee into the state convention, there wasn't a plank for that position. And so a lot of the activists who were there argued that the platform committee had improperly removed that because it was duly approved by the districts. There was a lot of back and forth rule debate. Eventually, they just added it back in an amendment process during the platform discussion. So for another year, the Iowa Republican Party has made one of their platform goals to repeal same-sex marriage laws. And so that was kind of the big highlights this year.
I was going to ask you about that, so I'm glad you brought that up. So let me just ask real quick, Caleb, did you get a sense this debate sounded like it was about 80% over procedure and about 20% on the issue itself? Moving forward, is there a movement within the party to take that out of the statewide platform? And I guess how, is there a big enough movement to actually accomplish that? Or is it something that a strong majority of the party still wants to, have it in the platform that they're opposed to same-sex marriages?
I think there is a strong support for it, and I'm kicking myself. I was sitting there, and I think I was just like writing notes on my computer, and I didn't look at the actual percentage vote because they did show it of who's, because each delegate had a clicker to vote yes or no.
Right.
But there was debate, so there was kind of a rearranged amount of time for debate, and most of the opposition to adding that to the platform were essentially people saying that the government should be fully out of the process of marriage, and that should be something that is done by churches and outside government groups. It definitely seems that there is a contingent, especially the fact that the platform committee removed it, I think is telling that it's settled law. It's been settled at the state level for years and years. It's been settled at the national level for almost a decade that they should just kind of move on. But I think that there's enough of a support for it that it's going to be a stick around for a while at least.
Yeah. 15 years in Iowa, 2009 was the state Supreme Court ruling. Yep. And then it was 3 years later. It was 2012, right? The U.S. Supreme Court.
15. Ruling, 2015.
15, sorry.
So Caleb, one of the things I definitely took note of was that part of the response that Feenstra had was to take out an ad in like the convention program. And then he also called Kevin Virgil, who's being supported by Steve King, woke.
Yeah, that's right. And we were just discussing it would be good if we had a video portion of this podcast, because I do still have it right here. But yes, so it shows Kevin Virgil along with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a couple other people who I don't immediately, maybe Chuck Schumer, all kind of around here. And saying that he should go back to New York. Looks like Kevin Virgil got lost on his way back to the Big Apple. And yes, it calls him woke. We don't need any more woke outsiders telling Iowans what to do. So that is pretty scathing in a Republican primary. So yes, it was very interesting to see.
It was
paid for by Feenster's campaign.
Caleb, bring that one back to next week's episode. For the inaugural YouTube, more on that later, folks. That's a visual that needs to be shared. Wow, fantastic stuff. All right, let's move on now to those couple other looks back at the 2024 legislative session, because again, we just can't let it go. Caleb, you wrote a nice piece about how Governor Reynolds' legislative agenda fared during the 2024 session, but I want to start with Todd here. Todd, it seemed like it was sort of a mixed bag for Reynolds' agenda this year. Certainly a lot of her bills got back to her desk and either have already been or soon will be signed into law. But many of them returned in dramatically different shape than she sent them out. So, Todd, how would you score Governor Reynolds' legislative success in 2024?
Well, yeah, you're right. Some of the stuff she opposed, or she proposed, I'm sorry.
Proposed, yeah.
Proposed. Mm-hmm. Didn't quite come out the end of the sausage factory in a way that sort of resembled closely what she put on the table. But governors, you know, they generally get maybe their biggest thing that they want, especially when you've got party control of both chambers. And I mean, she did get an AEA bill. It was considerably scaled back from what she originally sought. And I think she may have been surprised at the depth of the opposition to what she wanted to do, which really made an impact, at least in the House, where people where most of the changes were made. The Senate went along, and so she got some changes. She got AEA budget cut and a new bureaucracy in the Department of Education to oversee AEAs. You know, Republicans used to be small government, but now they like to set up bureaucracies to make sure that people who don't agree with them necessarily are doing what they're supposed to. She tried to get the bill passed that would have defined man and woman. And I mean, I think the consequence of that would have been, in the eyes of the law, transgender Iowans would have had a hard time asserting their identity. Or, I mean, I think a lot of the folks on the other side called it, you know, that it would erase transgender people. And I'm not sure they were that far off the mark. So she rolled that out for some whatever reason. The legislature wasn't interested. It didn't get past the committee process. But generally, I mean, she got tax cuts. You know, the money is rolling in to the tune of $180 million for her education savings accounts for private schools. So I think she came out of the legislative session fairly well. Again, some of that stuff was unpopular, but I'm not sure that will matter in November.
Yeah, and Caleb, you asked the governor how her priorities succeeded or failed. What did she kind of summarize? And she has said, right, that I understand that you don't get everything that you put on the table.
Right, yeah. She said she felt good about it. You know, she pointed to, when talking about the AEA bill, the teacher salary increase that they were able to pass, that increases salary to $50,000 in over a couple of years. She talked about the tax cut bill that she signed. That's another one that changed pretty significantly from where she proposed it, but it did end up setting taxes lower than they would have originally been. So she was supportive of that. So yeah, I mean, I think she had a couple. I think the AEA and the tax piece especially were kind of big pieces that she has not expressed much disappointment that they were changed, but especially the AEA bill, she said, you know, was a good start, and that she thought that overall things went well.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of mix of that, of most of the, other than a couple of examples, and Todd listed one or two. She didn't get birth control without a doctor's visit again. And I thought there was one more that I was
thinking about. And paid parental leave for state employees.
Yes, thank
you. She said specifically that she was disappointed that that didn't go through. That was the second time she's proposed that.
Yeah. So some of those, but overall, like I said, a lot of bills got back to her, putting those biggest ones. They looked a lot different than the original bill draft. So it was an interesting session that way for her. Also looking back at the session, Caleb and Jared put together a piece talking to Northwest Iowa legislators about how they feel the session went. And this is obviously a discussion with a regional flavor, but it's instructive for all of us to hear because this is the part of the state where Iowa's conservatives reside. So Jared, give us some highlights from what y'all heard for that story about how Northwest Iowa legislators felt about the session.
Just want to make clear, Caleb did every part of the reporting for this. We gave him names and he got responses, and then I just cobbled it together for our website. So now that that's out of the way, I wasn't necessarily surprised, but I did take note that I think it was three different Republican legislators told Caleb that their disappointment from the session was the use of eminent domain for carbon capture pipelines not being addressed. It was Kevin Alons, Lynn Evans, and Jeff Taylor. That one's probably the least surprising considering the actions he's taken in the legislature. You know, I keep saying, perhaps even to the annoyance of some here on this podcast, that it's not an issue going away anytime soon. And three different legislators saying that is one of the biggest disappointments of the entire session is definitely proof. Another thing I took note of was that J.D. Scholten said the biggest disappointment of the legislative session was the dismantling of AEAs and said the process was unnecessary and chaotic. And the thing I took note of is that Jeff Taylor, who probably doesn't agree on much with J.D. Scholten, also said that a disappointment of the session was reform of the AEAs, and his reasoning wasn't wildly divergent from Scholten's, at least from what they both told Caleb. Because Taylor said, quote, "I was not convinced that the system as a whole was broken and needed to have greater centralization at the state level." That was definitely noteworthy.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, Caleb, was there anything else that was striking to you about some of the responses?
Well, one thing that I noticed, you know, still on the AEAs, and so I did this for all of Lee's coverage areas. So I got, you know, people in Quad Cities, Mason City, Waterloo, Sioux City, and Council Bluffs. There was, I think, I hope I'm remembering right, one, definitely not more than three Republican who pointed to the AEA changes as a success. The rest of them didn't mention it. They talked about other things. And some of them, like Jeff Taylor, said that they were not happy about it. And so that, you know, that goes back to what a lot of, you know, its opponents have said over the legislative session, is that none of the Republicans came into this session wanting to do that. It wasn't really something that was on their agenda.
Republicans said that during debate. There was at least one, and I can't remember now who it was, but I remember a Republican legislator literally saying exactly that also.
Yeah. Yeah. So that stood out to me for sure. And then, yeah, the pipeline situation as well. There were especially senators who didn't get the chance to take a vote on it. There were a lot of Republicans who were upset about that.
Yeah. Eminent domain was one of our, that's going to be back next year's stories that Caleb is speaking of, something that Caleb also wrote. So that's as easy a bet that there is out there right now. The big question is whether anything changes in the Senate, and we've got an election. So we'll see. This is something we can talk about as the year goes on and November gets closer, and as much as anything, how many Senate Republicans are retiring. I don't know that there's many, that many. I think there's a bunch in the House, but I don't know how many Senate Republicans are retiring. I'm going to have to look that up now.
I know at least for our area, it's all the same people running for re-election.
Yeah, I don't think it's very, very many. We'll find that out and know for the future. When we bring that up on a future episode of On Iowa Politics, that's going to wrap it up for this edition. Before we go, really quick, we kind of alluded to it, and this is probably irresponsible of me, but we're in it now before it's finally decided. But we love you as listeners, and we want to get this out to as many folks as possible and in many different ways as possible. So one of the things we've been talking about doing and may start doing soon, maybe nothing 100% certain right now, but maybe as early as next week's episode, is bring this to YouTube as well. So if you're a visual listener to podcasts, I know a lot of them record in that format as well. We've discussed doing that here with the On Iowa Politics as well. So in the very near future, and we'll obviously keep you posted, watch for this podcast coming to the YouTubes, which means now I got to go get a haircut and actually look respectable for recording in the future, which is the part of this new agreement that I don't care for. But I'm kidding. I don't look too bad right now. I could have probably recorded this one online. Caleb, I don't know. God, Caleb's just, he looks terrible.
My stuffed Snorlax in the background may need to be moved if we're going to the...
And I caught myself not knowing this a few times during. I'm going to have to be strategic about how and when I yawn or things like that. I don't want people to think, oh, Caleb's talking and he's boring Aaron to tears there. So anyways, watch for that in a future episode. But that's it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice. And you can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. And now that you listen to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you also subscribe to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Spotlight by Chai Songwriter featuring Alicia Monet is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Not a Gazette subscriber? There's no better time to support local journalism. View our latest deals for print and digital offerings at thegazette.com/subscribe. Stay informed. Be empowered. Subscribe to The Gazette today at thegazette.com/subscribe.